as well as Women's Wear Daily here at home, jumped on the story with blazing headlines. Both Ted and I denied it all politely, but not before Don, who was in London at the time, had been amused to read in one of the London papers of his mother's alleged romance with the Prime Minister. My dearest and most constant friend in these years was Polly Wisner. Tragedy had struck her in 1965, when her husband Frank, after a long illness, killed himself at their family farm at Galena, Maryland, in the same way Phil had. It was eerie to find our lives following so much the same pattern. Polly retreated for a long time after Frank's death, finally finding a wonderful companion in her second husband, Clayton Fritchie. Polly and I, frequently together with Joe Alsop, took many trips together over the years, often in search of some restful cure. Once on a skiing trip to Switzerland, the two of us were walking across a glacier, talking about aging and making observations about some of our friends, like Alice Longworth and Averill Harriman, who were a couple of decades ahead of us. I told Polly that I had decided how to handle aging gracefully. "We have to read a lot and not drink." There was a long silence from Polly, while the noise of ice crunching kept up its regular beat. Finally, she asked, "When do we have to start?" One of the first of our trips when we were both alone was in 1966 to my mother's favorite spa, Saratoga Springs. While we were there, Truman Capote phoned me to say he was going to give a ball to cheer me up. What he said would be, "The nicest party, darling, you ever went to." My initial response was, "I'm fine. It's really nice of you, but I don't need cheering up." But Truman went right on talking of his plans, paying no attention to me. He explained that he'd always loved the grand ballroom at the Plaza and also the Ascot scene in My Fair Lady, for which his friend Cecil Beaton dressed everyone in black and white. He had decided to have everyone at his ball dress in black and white, too, and wear masks, which they would remove at midnight. I was to be the guest of honor. I was puzzled by the whole idea and not sure if Truman was serious, so I didn't think about it much. But when Polly and I joined Truman for lunch at 21 soon afterwards, I realized that this party was more about him than about me. I think he was tired from having written In Cold Blood and needed to be doing something to re-energize himself. I was a prop. In any case, the excitement began to build. Truman's black and white ball, as it became known, was the height of my social life then, in some ways ever. The gossip columns quickly went into action about who was and wasn't asked for the November 28th event. In the weeks before the party, whole pages of magazines and newspapers were devoted to the young beauties from New York and around the world who would be attending, their dresses, their hairdos, their masks. Truman spent hours developing the list of invitees. At one point, he was quoted as saying, "I decided that everyone invited to come stag had to be either very rich, very talented, or very beautiful, and of course preferably all three." The list included people from New York, Kansas, scene of In Cold Blood, California, Europe, Asia, South America. From stage and screen and the literary and artistic worlds, business executives, and the media world, all friends of Truman's. The guests included Janet Flanner, The New Yorker's Genet, correspondent from Paris, Diana Trilling, Claudette Colbert, Frank Sinatra and his new wife, Mia Farrow, Glenway Westcott, Thornton Wilder, Catherine Ann Porter, Virgil Thompson, and Anita Loos. I was allowed to invite 20 couples from Washington. I had a French dress, a Balmain design, copied at Bergdorf Goodman. It was plain white crepe, with slate-colored beads around the neck and the sleeves. The mask was made to match, also at Bergdorf's, by Halston, who was then still making hats. The only direction I gave Halston was to remind him that I was 5 feet 9 inches tall and didn't want something that would stick up too far. I also told him that Truman and I would be receiving the party-goers, so I couldn't have a mask on a stick that had to be held. I had begun going to the salon of the hairdresser Kenneth when I was in New York, but no one knew me there. I didn't have anyone special who did my hair, and I had never had makeup put on. I certainly didn't know how to put it on myself. I was leaving Kenneth's the night before the ball when a woman I knew who worked there said, "We're so busy, Mrs. Graham, with the hairdos for the black and white ball. Have you heard about it?" "Yes," I replied. "It seems funny, but I'm the guest of honor. She gasped and asked who would be doing my hair. I wasn't sure, and I knew I had no appointment for makeup at all. She swung into action and insisted that Kenneth himself do my hair. In fact, she led me to him straight away, and I was given the last appointment at the very end of the next day. I sat watching while he pinned curls all over the beautiful Marissa Berenson's head, one by one. Finally, he got to me, and the wait was worth it. I wound up looking my very best. Of course, in that company, compared with the sophisticated beauties who blanketed the ballroom, my very best still looked like an orphan. Truman had planned everything, down to the last detail. He arranged dozens of dinners before the ball and assigned everyone to one of them, thus maintaining complete control. He and I went to the Paleys for a drink and then left for the plaza. We had to get through a crowd that was already gathering in front, including a bank of almost 200 television and still cameras set up in the lobby. It was both exciting and terrifying. I had never seen anything like it, let alone been the object of that kind of attention. Truman had asked me to arrange only one thing: get the two of us a picnic dinner that we could have in a room at the hotel while we were waiting to go down to the ballroom to receive the guests. Knowing that what he mainly wanted was caviar and champagne, I decided to order a bird in a bottle from 21. Having never lived this kind of life, I'd never bought caviar before, and when told its price, decided on a quarter of a pound, which was barely a couple of spoons for each of us. In addition, the chicken was dry. I was chagrined, but luckily Truman was so excited that he remained good-tempered. We went downstairs promptly at 10 p.m. to greet the guests, a few of whom had already arrived. By 10:30, they were pouring in. I stood next to Truman, who introduced everyone to me. One of the most stunning moments came and went very quickly, so quickly that I barely had time to speak or look. Truman turned to me and said, with great emphasis, "Here's Jack." It was his friend Jack Dunphy, who was always behind the scenes and never appeared in public with Truman, but had been persuaded to come to the ball. Curiously, once people managed to get through the press gauntlet outside, they seemed to forget the cameras and the self-consciousness, and the ball became a genuinely intimate, easy, even cozy party. Peter Dushan's magic music and the very good, simple food helped enormously. There were memorable scenes, such as Lyndon Johnson, Margaret Truman Daniel, and Alice Roosevelt Longworth meeting, all the daughters of presidents, and Lauren Bacall and Jerome Robbins dancing up a storm. Truman had invited quite a few young people, including Marietta Tree's youngest daughter, Penelope, then just 16. Knowing that Penelope was going to be extraordinary, he had defied Marietta by inviting her. Susan Mary Alsop remembers sitting that night with Marietta and Ronnie Tree in the Tree's library before leaving for the ball, when in walked this schoolgirl wearing a black leotard, which in those days was staggering in itself, and some sort of a little top, and carrying a black and white mask. Susan Mary recalls her looking absolutely gorgeous and with a beautiful figure. Her governess followed her into the library, in tears, not knowing what to do. Penelope was allowed to go to the ball, and Diana Vreeland, ever the sharp, observant editor, hired her that night, and she became one of the highest-paid models in New York. Why was I the guest of honor? Who knows? Truman and I were good friends, but we were on a less intimate basis than he was with Babe or Morella, probably the two most famous beauties in the world. In discussing who was more beautiful, Truman once said, if they were both in Tiffany's window, Morella would be more expensive. He was also great friends with Slim Keith and Pamela Hayward and Lee Radziwill. In the end, however, when he had fallen out with so many of his friends, he never turned on me as he did on most of them. I think he felt protective of me. Truman knew I didn't lead the glamorous kind of life that many of his friends did. He may have given the party for me primarily, so that I could see it all up close, just once. I also think I was appropriate for the occasion, because I really was a sort of middle-aged debutante, even a Cinderella, as far as that kind of life was concerned. I didn't know most of these people or their world, and they didn't know me. He felt he needed a reason for the party, a guest of honor, and I was from a different world, and not in competition with his more glamorous friends. One of Truman's biographers, Gerald Clark, conjectured, She was arguably the most powerful woman in the country, but still largely unknown outside Washington. Putting her in the spotlight was also his ultimate act as Pygmalion. It would symbolize her emergence from her dead husband's shadow. She would become her own woman before the entire world. The coverage of the party, here at home and internationally, went on for weeks after the event, giving Truman enormous pleasure. Mrs. Longworth said that the party was the most exquisite of spectator sports, which the New York Times used as the headline for its extensive story on the event. The Post, in an ambiguous position, ran the story on the front page of the women's section. The day after the ball, I got a call from Diana Vreeland asking me to have everything put back on, the hair, the face, the dress, and to pose for photographs by Cecil Beaton again. He had done some photos of me before the ball, since she thought I looked so much better fixed up by Kenneth. Arthur Schlesinger wrote a flattering piece to go with those photos, and it ran in Vogue the following January. My own reaction to all this attention was mixed. The publicity and higher profile frightened me a little, and might actually have hurt me, and probably should have, given the serious professional person I was trying to be. Oddly, however, the party itself for the most part escaped being described as Marie Antoinette's last fling. Perhaps this was because the women's movement had not yet come to the fore, and it was before the most serious racial urban problems surfaced, and before Vietnam became the burning issue that so dominated our society. This was the last possible moment such a party could take place and not be widely excoriated. To a certain extent, of course, it was. Pete Hamill reviewed it in the New York Post and juxtaposed wisps of conversations from the party with horror stories from Vietnam. My Quaker friend Drew Pearson, who had come to the ball as my guest because I loved his wife Louvie, wrote a highly critical column, this after promising Louvie that if he came he wouldn't comment negatively, saying that Truman's party overshadowed the tragedy in Kansas, which won him fame, and that Morella Agnelli should have donated the price of her dress to flood relief in Italy. For me, the party was just great pleasure, maybe doubly so because it was unlike my real life. I was flattered, and although it may not have been my style, for one magic night I was transformed. In 1966, Don Graham graduated from Harvard, magna cum laude, despite having spent most of his time editing The Crimson. He had decided to volunteer for the Army and not wait to be drafted, a decision that surprised me. I had supposed he would go on to graduate school, which you were still allowed to do, and stay draft-exempt. Most of Don's friends were against the war, and Don himself had reservations, but when I asked him about his decision, he quietly replied, "The rich are staying in school and the poor are being drafted. I can't live with that." The possibility, or probability, of his going to Vietnam concerned me, but there was no way to argue with that kind of thinking. On August 22, 1966, I drove Don to Washington's Union Station early in the morning. We said goodbye, and he got on the train, headed for Fort Bragg, North Carolina. It was an awful scene, so reminiscent of Phil's departure for the Army 24 years earlier. Don's reaction to the military was like Phil's, too, depressed by the nearly complete lack of logic in Army routine, the mindless brutality he saw everywhere, and the rules designed to promote fear. While still in college, Don had fallen in love with a fellow Crimson editor, Mary Whistler, and they decided to get married. I questioned this decision mildly, on grounds of youth, they were both 21, and the confused emotions brought on by the Army, but he was adamant. Our whole family and Don's and Mary's friends assembled for the wedding in January 1967 in Chicago, where Mary had grown up. Only 6 months later, Don was on his way to Vietnam. The war was just beginning to be the searing, anguishing issue it later became, and now it invaded my personal life. Don's letters throughout the year he spent in Vietnam, assigned to the 1st Air Cavalry, gave me my truest and best view of what was going on there. One of his first, written just 2 weeks after his arrival in the country, reflected skepticism already. "Though I cringe at the thought of what infantrymen do to the people over here, I admire them enormously for sticking it out, for fighting a war they hate in a country they loathe, for a cause they neither care about nor believe in. He wrote to Mary that, whatever the outcome of the war, the worst will not be for us, but for these poor, poor Vietnamese, who will go on suffering no matter what happens. In September, he wrote me, "The only thing I can vaguely see from over here is that many policies which seem bad are being pursued because it is impossible for the administration to change them without admitting serious previous error. Suppose McNamara now concluded that the bombing all along had been doing no good, that it had produced no substantial results and had to be stopped. Could Johnson turn around and say, 'Well, we have lost a few planes and a few hundred pilots and a few million dollars, but we have decided that we were in error?'" In January 1968, he wrote, "I bet this all sounds familiar. Probably Daddy wrote home about the same things. I expect there are a lot of things here anyone who saw World War II would find familiar. One thing must be missing, though. I've never heard anyone express much concern about how the war ends or whether it ends, or indeed any expectation that it will end before the expiration of anyone's tour." The one-year hitch, he added, which is responsible for our high morale and much more, is also responsible for this. For a while, the Post had only one reporter in Vietnam, Ward Just, who as early as mid-October of 1967 had a piece in Outlook about how hard it was to believe anything about Vietnam. Don read it and agreed, writing me, "There really is too damned much self-deception going on among the U.S. military in this country." From what he could see, civilian casualties in Vietnam were horrifying, and he added, "It just seems goddamned awful that we are doing such immense damage to people who are truly innocent bystanders, who never wanted us to fight for them, or the North Vietnamese. And even if the outcome of the war is somehow positive, I think our treatment of these people will ensure that no government considered too friendly to the U.S. will endure in South Vietnam." Meanwhile, as television brought the war right into our living rooms, the home front was beginning to boil. Many young people felt it was just as patriotic to protest the war as it was to serve the country by fighting in it. Don, hearing about the demonstrations across the country, worried about their effect. "I recognize people I knew as conservative or politically uninterested going through what I did, recognition of the radicals' home truths. War is bad. We are acting cruelly and terribly toward the Vietnamese. And the thrill that comes from participating in something like the protest. At the same time, over here, I talk to people who have had another totally changing experience. They have seen friends die, and they know they are going to die, and they don't want to die now. They could care less about what we do to the Vietnamese. We will come out of the war so fragmented. I wonder what will happen." I was seeing and experiencing some of that fragmentation in my own family. My second son, Bill, chose the opposite route of demonstrating and protesting against the war. Both Bill and Steve were of the generation that transformed this country. They let their hair grow, experimented with drugs, and led a new and different kind of life. That fall of 1967, Bill was arrested for demonstrating in front of the Oakland Induction Center during Stop the Draft Week. He appeared in a photograph with a raised hand, confronting a policeman, which the police maintained was a threat, but which Bill said was an act of self-defense, since he clearly wasn't about to try to hit an armed officer. The judge threatened to send all the protesters to jail. Our company lawyer, Bill Rogers, undertook to defend Bill, working through one of his law partners in San Francisco. I didn't want Bill to have a jail record, and in the end, Bill Rogers saved him from jail. But he got arrested again during his senior year for a sit-in at Stanford's Scientific Research Institute, which did some defense work. That time, the protesters hired a lawyer to represent them as a group, and I wasn't allowed to interfere. For me, it was strange and strained to have one son in the war in Vietnam and one at home demonstrating against it. To a certain extent, this was a product of their personalities, but even more it was the 3-year age difference between them. This difference of opinion didn't affect their relationship with each other or mine with either of them, but their two reactions certainly added to my own doubts about the war and eventually to my feelings about how the Post should position itself. Russ Wiggins, as editor of the Post, was overseeing the whole editorial and news operation, focusing on the editorial page for the most part, particularly after Ben came to manage the news side. Even though I was still basically following Russ's support of the administration, I was beginning to be concerned about our position on the war and had a lot of questions. Great heat had been focused on me, mostly by my friends Bill Fulbright and Walter Lippmann, and to some extent by Bobby Kennedy, whom I knew less well but saw occasionally. Fulbright had accused the Post of obsequiously following administration policy, and he invited me to lunch with him on Capitol Hill to try to get me to turn our editorial policy around. I listened, but I'm not sure with how much of an open mind. I was pretty convinced still that Russ was right about the war. I was also getting complaints from readers. In March 1966, before I had begun to be more questioning, I wrote one Post reader saying defensively, "We do in general agree with the White House position on Vietnam. While there is obviously a great deal of room for differences of opinion on this subject, we are in no way in touch with the White House, nor do we talk to anybody in it about our editorials." I wrote another woman in June 1967. "We approach our position on Vietnam with the same degree of concern and worry that everyone shares on this difficult and frustrating war. I am sure Russ Wiggins, the editor, keeps reviewing our policy on the bombing with an open mind. However, as long as we have 500,000 troops in the South, I suppose they need any support we can give them." Even so, I was becoming increasingly uneasy about the paper's position. I also saw that the news side and the editorial page were diverging more and more about the war. A 1966 editorial stated clearly, "We are in South Vietnam to preserve the right of a small people to govern themselves and make their own choices." War Just, a month later, wrote in a dispatch, "We are here defending freedom as we understand it, for people who don't." Thinking about the war in Vietnam consumed much of our time and energy at the paper during the late 1960s and early 1970s, nowhere more so than in editorial page conferences. Russ himself wrote most of the Vietnam editorials, at least through the end of 1966. Ben and I both knew that Russ had every intention of retiring at the age of 65, which he would reach at the end of 1968, so we were looking for someone to lead the page after that. Somehow, Phil Jalin, a respected diplomatic reporter for the Wall Street Journal, had got a message to Ben that he was interested in the job. In 1962, Phil Graham had tried to get Jalin to the Post, but he had decided to stay with the Journal. In the meantime, he'd grown restless there, and now that his friend Ben had come to the Post, he was much more positive about it. When Ben proposed the idea of Jalin, I welcomed it. In August of 1966, Phil and his wife Sherry came to visit me on Martha's Vineyard, where I was vacationing. He and I took long walks discussing everything about the paper, particularly the role of an editorial page in the nation's capital, his lack of knowledge of local issues, and what our relationship might be. I also suggested to Phil that he talk to Walter Lippmann, who, Phil later told me, gave him simple but great advice for an editorial page: beware of predictability. We spoke at some length about what I called the no-surprise rule. I told him something that I have said to every editor I've ever worked with: that I didn't want to read anything in the paper of great importance or that represented an abrupt change which we hadn't discussed, that I wanted to be in on the takeoffs as well as the landings. As editor, he would have real autonomy. I didn't expect to agree with every specific, but I expected to have a constant conversation in which we would each know what the other was thinking. I warned him that I didn't want to wake up more often than not to editorials with which I didn't agree. I recall telling him that if that turned out to be the case, something would have to give, to which he jokingly said he assumed that wouldn't be the owner. Most of all, we talked about Vietnam. Phil had made two trips to Vietnam for the Journal, as a result of which he had grown opposed to the war, concluding that it was unwinnable. But to my great relief, he was moderate in his views, and I felt comfortable with his thinking. We agreed that the Post ought to work its way out of the very supportive editorial position it had taken, but that we couldn't be precipitous. We had to move away gradually from where we had been. He used the image that changing our policy was like turning a great vessel around. You first had to slow down before you could start to turn. When Phil came aboard in January 1967 as an editorial writer, but clearly slated to succeed Russ, the tension within the editorial page staff increased, and the arguments about Vietnam at editorial meetings grew more vociferous. By this time, almost everyone on the page except Russ had begun to change his views on Vietnam. Herblock, who in 1965 and 1966 had kept his pen relatively benign on the war, began to draw cartoons that were much more critical of the administration's policies and decisions. Ward Just's reporting from Vietnam, which I viewed as perceptive, detached, and accurate, became tougher as he grew more disenchanted with the war. Russ, however, remained uncharacteristically locked into his position. Fortunately, he was always good-tempered and forgiving, and never personal in his passions, which made discussion possible despite the violent emotions Vietnam aroused. The back and forth between Russ and Phil resulted in a sort of two steps forward, one step back movement, but in the end the Post did begin to turn around its editorial position on the war. An amusing sidelight is that when Phil brought Meg Greenfield to the Post as an editorial writer in July 1968, Russ, in the throes of our debates over Vietnam, said to Phil, "My boy, you're making the mistake of your life. She's on my side." There were sides on Vietnam. What President Johnson seemed to feel as time went on was that he was on one side and I in the Post, except for his friend Russ, of whom he once said that one of his editorials was worth as much to him as a division in Vietnam, appeared to be on the other. The war definitely got in the way of my friendly relationship with Lyndon Johnson, but even before the war heated up, I seemed to have been on his bad side. He had stopped calling me himself, and by 1966, our relations were definitely somewhat distant. I was no longer asked to anything intimate or friendly, and though I was invited to state occasions from time to time, his greeting in the receiving line was frigid or almost non-existent. Because I saw Lady Bird regularly in connection with the beautification committee, and because I was so busy to begin with, I wasn't fully aware of how the president was distancing himself from me. The distance, however, was real. I was visited confidentially first by Bill Moyers and later by Bob Kintner, who served a brief stint in the White House. Both Bill and Bob, wanting to be helpful, carried the same strange story, that the president had heard I had called in my editors and told them that he was trying to influence me by inviting me to the White House and that they were not to pay any attention to this. The very idea that I would do such a thing was inconceivable to me. I was incredulous, but so impressed at having heard the same story twice that I decided to write the president to straighten things out. On May 16, 1966, I wrote him what I genuinely felt. "I hear from two of our mutual good friends that the Washington grapevine carried back to you something I was supposed to have said. I was both sad and baffled at how such an erroneous report could have been invented. It's terribly presumptuous of me to take up your time to assure you I would never think anything like what was attributed to me, much less say it, because if I had, it would have been pompous, stupid, and rude. I want you to know that I only think the things I said directly to you at the ranch about being for what you are trying to do for this country and believing very much in your ability and courage to do them. Because I am responsible for two publications, one or the other of them is probably bound in the nature of things to irritate you, or worse at times. And I am always sorry when we add to your problems, whatever reason. I only hope that at other times our support has been of some small pleasure or help. There are so many worries on your shoulders that I hesitate to bother you about this nonsense. I just decided there was too much in our past to leave such a horrid misapprehension lying around. Phil would not have liked it. Devotedly." This letter sounds toadying. It wasn't meant to be. I greatly admired President Johnson, even though I eventually differed with him on Vietnam. I had no problem if he was angry about our editorial policy on Vietnam, or even about our more objective news policy, as opposed to Phil's. What I minded then, and I mind now, is when misunderstandings get in the way of proper professional relations. The very real problems between the Post and any president are complicated enough without fictitious and malicious stories making unneeded trouble. Johnson had been a friend, but I also knew he was paranoid enough to let something like this weird story anger him. When LBJ responded the next week, it was with what I considered a slap in the face. "I was, of course, happy to hear from you in your letter. The spirit in which it was written is most welcome. Mrs. Johnson and I are fond of you, as we were of Phil. He is still very sorely missed by those of us who knew him so well. There is so much said and written that is untrue that to try to deal with it would be an endless task. Contrary to what some of your columnist colleagues seem to feel, I let most of it pass, but I do feel obligated to try to correct certain untruths that take on larger proportions than others. I owe that to the office, not to mention my family. A great deal of gossip and opinion winds up in print, often under the guise of fact. A great deal more makes the cocktail circuit. It is always good to expose it as such when possible, and that should be the duty and privilege of both of us." Clearly, Johnson found life with the post-Phil Graham newspaper difficult. Certainly, the president was growing more and more discomfited with our reporting, especially about Vietnam. To Johnson, loyalty was everything, loyalty as he defined it. The papers in Texas and their publishers were loyal. Phil Graham had been loyal. Why was I allowing my paper to report and say such things about his policies? From his point of view, according to those around him, Johnson saw me at times as masterminding the paper against his interests, and at other times as being too permissive, and he used his aides, especially Jack Valenti and Joe Califano, to approach or reproach me. After one call, Jack went back to him and said, "Well, Mr. President, Kay says that she doesn't write these stories and doesn't command the stories to be written." To which Johnson replied, "Well, by God, if I owned a goddamn newspaper, I ought to have some people around me who are going to do what I want. Hell, I'd just as soon have a pack of beagle dogs out there. At least I can train them." When Jack reminded him that he didn't tell his news people at the Austin station he owned what to report, the president replied, "I'm not down in Austin. By God, Kay Graham is sitting there in her office. She ought to know what the hell those goddamn reporters are writing." This is such a classic politician's attitude about a publisher. Every politician probably believes publishers sit in their offices doling out orders to reporters about what to write when. LBJ particularly hated reading stories in the Post that predicted what he was going to do. One of the early ones on which he and I crossed swords was when we had heard that he was going to appoint Walter Washington as the mayor of Washington, D.C. The president called me himself to say I had to understand that if we ran the story, Walter wasn't going to be appointed. Califano called Ben several times during the day, pleading with him not to run the story and thereby ruin Washington's chances. It was the good side of Ben, and the obdurate side as well, that there was no way he was not going to run the story. I didn't try to stop him. When we did print it, the president indeed held up the nomination for a few weeks, and then announced the appointment as he had planned. According to Jack Valenti, those leaks were kind of like somebody dropping carbolic acid on him. He considered them a personal affront. What the president never accepted, or even clearly understood, as most people don't understand, is the autonomy editors have and must have to produce a good newspaper. I used to describe it as liberty, not license. I felt then, as now, that I was never antagonistic to Lyndon Johnson. I was doing my job at the paper as I defined it, and he was doing his. On a couple of occasions, President Johnson did send for me on matters of business. One of the first was about his wanting to send John Hayes to Switzerland as ambassador. Hayes had helped LBJ with broadcasting problems during the campaign, and this was his reward. Carol Kilpatrick went in with Russ and me for what turned out to be a fairly leisurely and informal conversation, mostly on Vietnam. Among other things, the president talked about the recent bombing pause, saying he felt it was a mistake, because Ho Chi Minh could view it as a sign of weakness and vacillation. He looked directly at me and asked how my son would feel if we were walking down a street and someone slapped me on one side of the face and then stepped back and slapped me on the other, and my son's hands were tied behind his back. "Well," the president said, "that's the way our troops there felt during the bombing pause." LBJ believed the net effect was bad. It had prolonged the war, demoralized our side, and got us in trouble on the resumption. He obviously was worried about the war and about our casualties, reporting sadly that we had already lost 2,500 men and were now losing 50 a week, with the enemy losing many times more. When he asked us how we thought it would all end, Russ said he thought it most likely that there would be no formal conclusion to the war, but the president expressed confidence that it would end soon. In the summer of 1967, I went off on a trip to Europe that included a tour through the Greek islands and up the Dalmatian coast on a yacht chartered by Charles and Jane Reitzman. My mother, knowing that we would be going to Yugoslavia and having met Tito on a trip she had taken with Chief Justice Earl Warren and Drew Pearson, asked if I wouldn't like to meet with him. She had already written to him that I was coming. Tito hadn't given an interview in 2 years, and when he agreed to see me, I got off the yacht and went to Rome, where I spent 2 days preparing for the promised interview. Because Bill Pepper was Newsweek's bureau chief in Rome, he came along, and my son Bill, traveling in Europe at the time, came too. We flew to Belgrade, and from there went north somewhere, and were taken by motorboat to Tito's summer vacation island of Brioni. The moment we sat down in Tito's office, he started speaking at a very rapid pace, and obviously on the record. These were the days before tape recorders were routine. A quick glance at Bill Pepper made me realize that I'd better start taking notes, which I did for a solid 2 hours, while Tito talked over a range of subjects. Once we finished, we returned to Belgrade, where I slogged away, summarizing the interview as best I could, and sent the story off to the Post, where they ran it on the front page with my byline. Unlike the case at many newspapers, the Post's editors really were free to decide whether or not to use the publisher's contributions, and they often downplayed stories I sent back from these trips. Having been away from home for several weeks, I returned to find that problems had piled up while I was gone. I set to work, and also spent a week of many nights out, after which I went to Glen Welby with Billy, Steve, Lally, and Jan for what I hoped would be a restful family weekend. It turned out to unleash yet another crisis. We were in the middle of a tennis game, and I was about to serve when I looked up into the sun and passed out cold with a convulsion. It was actually much more frightening for those who witnessed it than it was for me, who didn't really understand what had happened. I came to with Billy and Jan reassuring me and saying that I had been unconscious, that they had sent for an ambulance, and that I would be taken to the George Washington University Hospital for tests. The doctors tested for everything, including a brain tumor, which was the most terrifying prospect. But after 6 days in the hospital, I was told simply that I had some sort of irregularity in my brain that could have come from anything, including an injury at birth or scars from the earlier TB. My doctor put me on an anti-seizure drug, Dilantin, a strong drug, which no one explained to me. It took me almost a year to get even somewhat used to it, and my body never quite accommodated to it. I would often have spells when I would suddenly feel faint or get palpitations and was worried that I'd never be able to travel again or even feel completely comfortable about engaging in sports or other rigorous activities. Later, hoping to get off the drug, since I had had no more seizures, I kept checking with the neurologists, who would do brain scans and tell me the problem still existed and that I had to keep taking the pills. Finally, after about 15 years, I found a brilliant neurologist who said, "I can't promise you'll never have another one if you stop taking it, but I'd rather see you have another one than stay on that drug." So I stopped, felt much better right away, and have never had another attack. Some weeks after the initial incident, I started to go out again. One of my first outings was to a small informal party at Liz and George Stevens's home, at which, after dinner, Bobby Kennedy started arguing with me about the Post's position on Vietnam, keeping up a steady drumbeat about how hopeless the war was and why didn't I do something about it. He was perfectly pleasant, but my head started pounding and I felt that I might faint. I knew I had to leave, so I quickly said to Bobby, "I'm terribly sorry. This has nothing to do with our conversation, but I have to go," and got out in a hurry. I so much didn't want him to think that I was avoiding conversation about the war that I wrote him a note saying I hadn't wanted to end the conversation, but had been afraid I was going to have some physical problems if I didn't leave. I got a charming letter back saying, I hope you are feeling better. I often have that effect on people, but they recover rapidly. The year 1968 was a crucial one for the country and for me personally. Our involvement in the war was tearing at the society more fiercely than ever. On March 16th, Bobby Kennedy announced that he would be a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. LBJ told Carol Kilpatrick in an off-the-record interview that Kennedy's announcement neither surprised nor upset him. In fact, he said that he had always believed Kennedy would run because the senator found something to criticize or object to in every one of his legislative proposals. Johnson still felt he was right about Vietnam and cited the fact that every Asian leader was telling him to hold on. Only 2 weeks after he spoke to Kilpatrick, however, the president stunned the world by announcing, at the end of some televised remarks about Vietnam, that he would not run for re-election, saying, I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. Lyndon Johnson, his famous energy flagging, took himself out of the race. In many ways, Lyndon had been consumed by the war in Vietnam. He remained bitter about what people thought of him and the extent to which the war obscured many of his domestic accomplishments. Just over a month after he withdrew from the race, Carol Kilpatrick spent several hours with him on a flight from Independence, Missouri, where Johnson had visited the Trumans. At one point, as Carol reported in a memo he wrote at the time, LBJ turned to Ray Shearer, a reporter for NBC, and began berating NBC as scandalously prejudiced against him. The only difference between the Kennedy assassination and mine is that I am alive, and it has been more torturous, he said. I think I understand the press a lot more than the press understands me. Political discussions within my family began to heat up as the campaign year progressed. Don, viewing some of this from afar, was amused to talk both to Lally, from her hospital bed, she had just given birth to her second daughter, and to my mother, ill and also in the hospital. And what did both want to talk about? Don wrote me. Bobby Kennedy, of course. Grandma evidently feeling anti, Lally pro. Family gatherings, I can see, will be more fun than ever. Perhaps I'll extend over here until after the convention. My mother was having an operation for breast cancer. I was very concerned. After all, she was 81 and basically wheelchair-bound from arthritis. But she still had a lot of mental energy and her old emotional approach to issues. I sat with her the evening before the operation and tried to chat about things that would keep her mind off it. The question of Bobby Kennedy had become an emotional one for her. Mother disliked him with an intensity that only she could muster. Instead of staying calm, she kept reverting to Bobby, attacking him savagely. I liked him very much, and found it difficult to listen to her tirades against him. Finally, I said firmly that we had to change the subject, and the moment passed. The next morning, my brother was with her as she began to emerge from the anesthesia. Still groggy, she opened one eye and asked clearly, Why does Kay like Bobby Kennedy so much? The American home front was experiencing tremendous tumult and upheaval that spring. In April, Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, and the country went up in flames. The situation in Washington deteriorated throughout the night of his assassination. I stayed at the paper, and several of us climbed up onto the roof to look out over the city at the large fires, especially on 14th Street, near the Post. Rioting and looting were taking place everywhere. Finally, over 14,000 National Guard troops were joined on the streets by the district's full contingent of nearly 3,000 police officers. Joe Califano, LBJ's aide, later said that they got one report at the White House that Stokely Carmichael was organizing a mob at 14th and U to march on Georgetown and burn it down. Joe recalled that President Johnson read the report, smiled, and said, God damn, I've waited 35 years for this day. Preserving his sense of humor in the middle of the riots while venting his ever-present disdain for what he viewed as an elitist enclave. The phone rang in my bedroom very early on the morning of June 5th. Ben was calling to tell me that Bobby Kennedy had been shot, adding, "We need to stop the presses and replate with the story. Jim Daly refuses to stop the presses, and I think you had better get down here." Daly, the Post's general manager, was haunted by the prospect of late delivery and dissatisfied subscribers. I arrived at the plant and found Harry Gladstein, the circulation director, on the back platform and asked him what our alternatives were. We decided that since it was already 4 a.m., beyond our usual delivery hours, we would go ahead and deliver the papers that had been printed and then recover the routes with a special edition. It would be expensive, of course, but if we wanted to tell our readers about this shattering piece of news, this was what we had to do. My decision to proceed caused yet another problem in my relationship with John Sweeterman. I should have checked with him, but I was there on the spot and simply didn't think in that kind of managerial way. In fact, John had been on his way into the paper, and when he got there, he said to me icily, "I hear you've been giving orders on the loading dock." I said I had, and that time we both retreated. I imagine that John would have given the same order, because he was always willing to spend money when it mattered, and it clearly mattered in this case. Another change in a relationship took place at the time Bobby died, this one not directly connected with me, but with the paper. Herb Block had drawn a cartoon with a roll of dishonor on it, listing all the senators who had voted against gun control. The caption on it was, "Murder." It seemed to Phil Jalen that publishing Herb Block's cartoon on the day of Bobby Kennedy's assassination was just too rough, and he decided to take the caption out and leave the cartoon. Herb was furious and reacted strongly. Not only did the incident result in no speak between the two of them for at least 6 months, but Herb gradually removed himself from editorial control, becoming more and more independent. He started to, and still does, walk out into the newsroom to check his judgment with a group of people whom he likes and trusts. It was an irritating arrangement for Jalen, but by that time Herb was so powerful and respected that he could get away with flaunting his independence. The next day, June 6th, I went to Resurrection City with the Reverend Walter Fauntroy, a black minister and city leader, to see the muddy, cold area where the blacks and civil rights leaders who had marched on Washington at that time were camped. On the 7th, I flew to New York for Bobby's funeral the following day at St. Patrick's Cathedral. It was a highly emotional service, followed by an equally wrenching ride back to Washington on the funeral train for the burial in Arlington Cemetery. The memory of that day is seared into my mind, watching the mourners lining the railroad tracks and the weeping people in the stations and making the sad climb up to the spot on the hill in the cemetery beside where his brother was buried. To me, Bobby was a complex character. He could be very tough, as he was and probably had to be as JFK's campaign manager. We had occasionally been at odds, and he had once reduced me to tears over a piece on Jackie Kennedy that had appeared in the Post. At a dinner at Joe Alsop's, Bobby attacked me in the paper about the article, saying sharply to me, "You have lost your husband too, you should know better." His comment caused Joe to shake his head and mutter, "It's like a young nephew attacking his rich old aunt." We had both got past that and become friends. Like thousands of others, I saw him grow and change and become a significant political figure, relating to people with a charisma different from but as compelling as JFK's. Though I had some concerns about Bobby's positions on certain issues, he had become a passionate and articulate advocate for many of the things in which I deeply believed. Much of the summer of 1968 was taken up with political matters of one kind or another. Without Johnson and Kennedy in the picture, the presidential election campaign took on a different shape, with Hubert Humphrey, Eugene McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Nelson Rockefeller, and George Wallace all in the running. Having made his famous "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore" speech, Nixon had returned to political life. He had a number of image problems to overcome and had worked throughout the primary season to accomplish that. In mid-July, he came to an editorial lunch at the Post. Among those who attended were Don Graham, safely back from Vietnam only a week earlier, as well as several reporters and editors. Rockefeller had been there the week before, arriving for lunch with an entourage of sorts. Nixon came alone. He began by saying how glad he was to be at the post and welcomed the gathering. I mentioned that I thought he and I had first met in 1946. "No, Kay," he said confidently. "It was 1947. We met at that marvelous house of your parents. There were a lot of very prominent people there, and I couldn't figure out what I, a very poor congressman, was doing in that company." We sat down to lunch, which Nixon refused to eat on the grounds that he had to watch his weight. I persuaded him to have some iced coffee, which he took, but never touched. At least two people made notes after the lunch, and two memos, one from an editor, Al Horn, and one from Ward Just, have survived, which recall what we discussed and what Nixon said at the time. He felt confident that he would win the nomination on the first ballot, and commented that Rockefeller had even less chance with the Republicans than McCarthy did with the Democrats. He was already thinking about his running mate, but knew it would depend on which state he needed to win the general election. He mentioned several possibilities, Spiro Agnew not among them. He offered the opinion that Humphrey would do best if he ran in the opposite direction from the administration's record, which turned out to be accurate, but Humphrey separated himself from Johnson too late to make much difference. On the Vietnam War, Nixon felt that things had changed a great deal since he was last in a position of power, that the domino theory wasn't as valid in 1968 as it had been. He also recognized that the public clearly wanted to end the war, but that the new president had to hold out for some kind of honorable settlement. Nixon handled himself so brilliantly throughout the lunch that we were all truly impressed. Meg Greenfield, who had only just come to the paper, said she'd have to go home and lie down to think over what she'd seen and heard. Jalen, in reflecting on this episode later, said he thought it was one of those rare moments in Nixon's life when he didn't feel threatened by anybody. He was on top of the world, with the convention all locked up. But as soon as he got to Miami, at the slightest challenge from Rockefeller and Reagan, Nixon began to feel threatened, worrying that those two would somehow get together and stop him. It was then that he turned mean again, according to Phil. "I attended the Republican convention and witnessed Nixon's nomination, an extraordinary comeback from his defeat for the governorship in California." Later, Steve and I flew together to Chicago, right into the stresses of the Democratic convention. Humphrey emerged the winner over McCarthy, the peace candidate, but the chaotic convention hurt him mortally going into the fall campaign. Few would soon forget the images of the violence of the demonstrations outside in the streets, which I witnessed close up along with Nick von Hoffman, or the picture, televised nationally, of Mayor Daley signaling to cut the demonstrators off by making a slashing motion across his throat. At the Post, we stuck by our policy of non-endorsement, at least in theory. In effect, we supported Humphrey indirectly by saying in our editorials, "If you believe in this or that, then you'll want to vote for X or Y." At the time of Nixon's nomination, the Post had carried an editorial saying that he had shown an admirable understanding and restraint in his public approach to Vietnam, a commendable comprehension of some aspects of the nation's social ills. However, it also said that in private, he has revealed a disquieting disregard for principle, not to say good sense, in his discussion of the war, of the courts, of open housing and gun control and other things. As well as we ought to know him by now, he remains remarkably unknown. We had also editorialized about Nixon's choice of a running mate. In an editorial titled "The Perils of Spiro," we said, "Given enough time, Nixon's decision to name Agnew as his running mate may come to be regarded as perhaps the most eccentric political appointment since the Roman Emperor Caligula named his horse a consul." Ward Just, then writing editorials, wrote this one and also said, "You can view Agnew with alarm, or you can point to him with pride. But for now, we prefer to look on with horrified fascination." My mother, ever the political commentator, wrote me before the election, sending along a form letter she had received from Nixon that had been addressed to "my fellow citizens of the Jewish faith," and extending Jewish New Year's greetings. She appended the note, "I do think that he gives the Washington Post more opportunities for humor than the editorial department realizes." Hubert Humphrey had become a friend of mine. I admired him greatly, and feel he would have made an ideal president. Humphrey, however, had never been a favorite of Lyndon Johnson's, who considered him gabby, going so far as to remark often to Jack Valenti, "Those people from Minnesota, they just can't keep their mouths shut." LBJ felt Humphrey's gabbiness got him into trouble because he ended up leaking information that cost the administration. He didn't think that Humphrey leaked deliberately, but that he was so effervescent he would talk when he should have been listening. Of course, Johnson was right about Humphrey's being effusive, but he could also be remarkably eloquent, reducing people to laughter and tears almost simultaneously. He often made off-the-cuff brilliant remarks, but then would not be able to stop, and would go on until the dazzling effect wore off and the audience grew restless instead of mesmerized. Hubert's saving grace was his humor. He was just incredibly funny, and I found him to be a wonderful companion always. But despite Humphrey's attractive qualities, Richard Nixon was elected in one of our closest elections. Phil Jalin wrote the Post's editorial on Nixon's victory, saying he had fully earned the opportunity to test himself. He has also earned encouragement, cooperation, good wishes, and an open mind among those whose security and welfare have been placed in such large measure in his hands. Even Herb Bloch provided Nixon with a honeymoon, however short. In his cartoons throughout the campaign, indeed throughout Nixon's entire political career, Herb had drawn him with a 5 o'clock shadow that seemed to grow darker as the weeks and years went by, becoming almost a beard at some point. Russ Wiggins had sent Herb a razor, suggesting that maybe it was time to give Nixon a shave. When we discussed the beard at an editorial conference one day, Herb pointed to a picture of Nixon in that day's paper, which clearly showed a heavy growth of beard to be a distinguishing feature of the man. He claimed that the dark face was a characteristic like any other, large ears, a prominent nose, whatever, and therefore fair game for a cartoonist. Actually, Herb's cartoon that appeared after Election Day made it clear he recognized that a president of the United States has to be handled somewhat differently from a candidate for the office. He drew his own office as a barbershop with a sign on the wall that read, "This shop gives to every new president of the United States a free shave. H. Bloch, proprietor." Much had been going on at the Post while this political year proceeded. Typically and modestly, Russ had notified me in June 1968 that he would indeed retire on his 65th birthday, without any undue fanfare or attention, at the end of the year. As Russ explained in his letter to me, he had a personal distaste for a lot of flap, and also felt that this way would be better for the institution. I wrote Russ that I literally could not imagine the Post without him. Of all the helpful people there when I was new to my job, Russ was the most helpful. "The nicest thing you did was to take me seriously when a lot of people wouldn't have, but not too seriously, which was just right." In fact, Russ left earlier than expected, because President Johnson appointed him ambassador to the United Nations in late September. It had been 21 years since Russ's arrival at the Post, and it was a wrench for me to see him leave. Russ's departure caused a series of changes in the structure of our organization and in the management of the news and editorial side of the Post. Being non-political and non-partisan, Ben was geared to hard news and never much interested in editorial. So, when he became executive editor after Russ left, we both agreed that the editorial page, which was now under Phil Jalin, should report to me rather than to him. I didn't know Meg Greenfield very well then, and at first I was puzzled that Phil took her everywhere with him. Meg rapidly made her own place in the organization, and only 10 months after she had come to the paper, I sent Phil a note saying I'd been thinking about the necessity for him to have a number two eventually, and wondered if it might be Meg. "Or do you discriminate? Or would she hate it?" Just a year after she arrived, Phil named her deputy editor of the editorial page. I gave him great credit for appreciating Meg's amazing mind and extraordinary ability both to write and to edit, and her prodigious capacity for work. It was foresighted of Phil to make her his deputy, well ahead of upward mobility for women. For Phil, Meg was a real partner. He once described their working together as being like two people at the piano playing chopsticks. These years were filled with executive turnover, the blame for which was often laid at my doorstep, sometimes incorrectly. One instance, where Ben did the hiring and the letting go, took place when he became executive editor of the Post and his job of managing editor fell open. Ben brought in Gene Patterson, the former managing editor of the Atlantic Constitution, who had a reputation for the kind of independent-minded, tough, straight editing we all admired. But over a 3-year period, a combination of mismatched temperaments, overlapping responsibilities, and newsroom politics convinced Ben that things weren't working out. He aired his doubts to Gene, and Gene resigned immediately. When he left the Post, Gene summed up his feelings by saying, "Ben Bradley needs a managing editor like a boar needs tits." This was a quote that amused Ben vastly, but it accurately spelled out what Gene had long suspected. There was no job there. Miraculously, we all stayed friends, a remarkable tribute to Gene's classy, lovely character. Howard Simons, then deputy managing editor, moved right up when Gene left and accommodated himself to Ben's personality and Ben's ways. He was willing and able to do the job as Ben defined it, to do the things Ben didn't and wouldn't do, either because they bored him or because his attention was elsewhere. It would have been hard to portray this relationship accurately on an organization chart, but theirs was a partnership that worked well. Fortunately, Howard had talents complementary to Ben's. He was especially interested in what he irreverently dubbed SMERSH, science, medicine, education, religion, and all that shit. And he created and headed a group of reporters who began to look more closely at these areas and to report on them more fully. He was a great handholder, and he developed many young people whom he spotted, hired, and tracked. And he had a droll pixie humor which delighted us over the years. Increasingly, I found the confidence to pass along ideas or criticism or praise of stories that appeared in the Post or Newsweek, and I got great pleasure if a story idea I had passed on to the editors eventually made it into print and had some impact. Howard recognized my gratification in these small things and teased me occasionally with a Brenda Starr Award for reporting. In true Brenda fashion, I once gave a story to Ben that he later regretted not trusting me on. Truman Capote had confided in me that he knew Jackie Kennedy was going to marry Aristotle Onassis, an enormous story if true. I called Ben from South America, where I was on a trip, and told him I was sure Truman was right. Ben cabled back, "You're great, Brenda, but I chickened. Source confirmed, but everyone else reached, and we reached scores, most skeptical, and I decided 'twas too thin a reed to stake the paper's reputation." Of course, Truman was right, and the Post missed my scoop. Fortunately, Ben and I didn't hold incidents like this against each other. Howard was also a constant fount of ideas, some good, some not so good. He kept me well stocked with things to think about for the future of the paper. He sent me countless memos about his ideas for improving the Post, never mincing words, and once prefacing his comments by saying, "Eat this after reading." It was Howard who suggested exploring the publication of a weekly magazine to be distributed in the Friday Morning Post, in essence, the weekend section, which remains an important feature of the paper. Howard often addressed his memos to me as Mama, a nickname both he and Ben used, although with Ben it was usually Mums. It didn't bother me. In fact, I liked it. The team of Ben and Howard functioned smoothly for many years and only began to unravel after Watergate. I had lost one old friend and important person at the Post when Russ left in the fall of 1968, and toward the end of that same year, John Sweeterman told me that he wanted to be relieved of his day-to-day publishing responsibilities, in effect, to retire. Despite my difficulties with him, I was fully aware of all he had done and was doing for the paper, how essential he had been, from his arrival in 1950, when the Post was a losing paper, through the merger, to our present position of stability and strength. Fritz and I both tried to dissuade him, but he remained firm. Later he told me that he was tired and had had it, sort of. I just wanted the freedom. When I realized he was serious, we named him to the newly created post of vice chairman of the board of the company to be concerned with planning for the future development of all of its divisions. I also asked him to help me find someone to replace him. John said that I could and should become the publisher. At the time, I was president of the company, and held no title at the paper. My immediate response was to say that I couldn't and that we'd have to find someone, but John was adamant. With trepidation, I decided to take the title, which my father and Phil had had before me, and to look for a new business head of the paper. But I hadn't the remotest idea how to organize a search that would evaluate anyone properly. I still didn't know about headhunters, nor did I know the industry. I didn't even know exactly what skills the job called for. After sounding out one or two people whom I knew in the industry, I turned to my friend, Bob McNamara. Bob recommended Paul Ignatius, who had been the Secretary of the Navy and was reputed to have gotten the supplies to Vietnam. The qualities in Paul that were described to me by people he had worked with ranged from imaginative to budget-minded and profit-oriented, in all of which we were certainly interested. He had also been in charge of several building projects, and since a new building for the post was uppermost on my mind, I decided this was a good fit, and that although he didn't know the newspaper business, he could learn it. So I hired him, and Paul came on board as president of the newspaper and executive vice president of the Washington Post Company in January 1969. Almost from the outset, his tenure was troubled. It was a painful period for both of us. I knew he wasn't going to work out 6 months into the arrangement, and I told Fritz then that we had made a mistake. Fritz correctly told me that I was being too hasty and that I had to give him a chance, and we carried on with Paul well into 1971. John's departure, in fact, ushered in a very difficult period for me. Problems seemed to arise everywhere, and I found managing the company to be a nearly impossible task at this time. At the Post, production was going from bad to worse, compounded by increasingly severe labor difficulties. At Newsweek, both editorial and business were troubled. At the stations, there was worry about profits and margins. None of this was happening in a vacuum. I felt that I could manage one problem at a time, if only everything else would hold still while I concentrated on it. But no, the whole company kept spinning. I fretted that I wasn't up to it, that all the qualities I was lacking added up to an overwhelming deficiency that might very well work to the detriment of the company. I worried that the company might actually fail, and I stayed worried. I suffered over my decisions and my non-decisions, my sins of commission as well as my sins of omission. Of the many mistakes I made along the way, the ones that tormented me most were those that seemed to be written in concrete, like buildings and labor contracts, which at least felt like concrete. One of the most painful episodes had to do with a new plant for the paper. We chose I.M. Pei as the architect, but wasted nearly 4 years in the process of planning and designing an elaborate building that wasn't going to work for the production of the paper. In the end, not only we, but Pei became discouraged. We decided to cut our already great losses and stop working on what certainly would have been the wrong building for us. Except for our undue haste in turning again to the less distinguished firm that had built the original structure and then pushing that group to get started too quickly, I believe that dropping Pei's firm was the right decision for us, despite all the money and time wasted. It was the right decision, but I hated it. Ever since we completed the building in 1972, I have had the most ambivalent feelings about the structure I work in, which is plain, dowdy, and full of compromises. On too many days, any one of its features reminded me that the decision-making process, and my role in it, had been poor. I still had a lot to learn. Yet despite the turmoil and self-doubting, many things at the Post and the company were going well. One of the groundbreaking achievements at the paper under Ben's direction was the creation of the style section, replacing what before then was known as the women's section and called For and About Women in print. The new section was Ben's idea, with Dave Laventhal the chief implementer. Dave had outlined what it should include: people rather than events, private lives rather than public affairs, and to whom it should be addressed: Washingtonians of both sexes, black and white, suburbanite and city dweller, decision maker and homemaker. Pre-launch, the section was called Trial Balloon. There were a number of meetings on what to rename it until Ben came up with Style, an abbreviation for lifestyle, which he thought was a bogus word, and this was adopted. When Style first appeared, I was cautiously optimistic. I didn't like some of what I saw, but was willing to reserve final judgment. Fairly soon, however, I became more and more distressed over the direction the new section was taking. But I was unsure how to criticize constructively something I wanted to improve. I tended to apply a dentist drill too frequently, instead of considering things coolly and not constantly complaining. One of Ben's strengths is that he stood by his convictions, even if it meant standing up to me, and one of our rare square-offs had to do with style. Once he cautioned me, "Give us time, it's coming." Another time he said to me sharply, "Get your finger out of my eye," a stern directive that shook me up, especially because he had always been so good-tempered. It upset me enough so that I